Hi, welcome back to the EdTech Classroom Podcast. In this episode, Bert and I have two special guests that attended the EDUCON 2.2 at the Science Leadership Academy in Philadelphia.
Welcome to the EdTech Classroom Podcast, your source for practical tips to integrate technology into your classroom or your home. Whether you're a teacher, parent, or simply tired of the same old podcast, this is the place for you. We've got all kinds of free stuff at our website at edtechclassroom.com. And now our hosts, broadcasting from around the nation, Joe Wood in Sacramento, California, Bert Lowe in Modesto, and Karen Chichester in Michigan.
Welcome back to the EdTech Classroom Podcast, and our guests today are Devin Black from the New York City area and Damian Barexia from New Jersey, Pennsylvania area, and we're going to talk today about their experiences at EDUCON 2.2 in Philadelphia, which was held at the end of January of this year. Devin, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do and all that fun stuff.
Okay, I'm an inner-city special education teacher in a middle school in the Bronx, New York. I came to teaching when I was 50 years old. I've been doing it for I'm in my sixth year now, and EDUCON was my first trip to EDUCON. I watched it online last year, and was determined to go, and I was able to do it.
Oh, good. And Damian?
Okay, hi, I'm Damian Barriex. I'm a school psychologist, and I work in a rural/suburban area of northwest New Jersey, though I live in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And I'm in my 10th year of education right now. I was a high school English teacher prior to finishing my school psychology degree. And I've been a school psychologist for the last 2 years now. And like Devin, I also, this is my first EDUCON, even though I only live about an hour or so north of the city. And I followed a lot of what was happening at prior EDUCONs over Twitter. And, you know, again, like Devin said, this year I've got to make it. And there's always been an issue that one of the kids was sick or I had grad work or this or that. And this year the stars just aligned in such a way that I was able to make it down there for one day at least.
Oh, that's good. You know, I like you guys have been able to follow it online. And that's part of what's always attracted me to this conference. What would you say makes EDUCON different from other conferences you've attended?
Well, first of all, it's not a technology conference. It's an education conference. And the only other conference I've attended was the National Educational Computing Conference, NEC, in Washington, D.C. in June. So EDUCON is much smaller, much more focused, and more about education, less about technology.
No,
I would.
I'm sorry. Is it different in that the sessions are scheduled differently than NEC, or how is that difference from technology focusing on education made?
Well, first of all, it's smaller by exponential degrees. It's about 200, 300, 400 people at EDUCON and 20,000 at NEC. The focus at EDUCON is teaching. It's at a school. It's made up primarily of teachers and education professionals rather than tech people. It's more about how education can use technology rather than about the technology and how it might fit into education.
And I think the fact that we are talking about a much smaller group of individuals here is again something that's different. I've never been to NEC or to ISTE, but I have been to other conferences in the New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania areas, and they've always been much bigger than EDUCON. But the fact that it's so small really enables dialogue. There's a lot of conversation. In fact, they don't even call them sessions or presentations. They call them conversations. And I think there was much more emphasis on multi-directional dialogue at this conference as opposed to, the standard, psychology conferences or English conferences I go to where I'd sit and I'd be lectured to and be read off of a PowerPoint to, And this allowed, at least many of the sessions allowed for a lot more dialogue among the conference goers so that you may have had one or two people who were kind of facilitating the conversation, but they were not necessarily presenting, like lecturing, in the way a lot of traditional conferences do.
So one of these facilitators would pick a topic, I guess, and present it to EDUCON as, hey, I want to have a conversation about this, and you had two or three conversations to choose from an hour, or?
I think
more like five or six to choose from an hour.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the Saturday I was there, there were a total of three conversation sessions, and then there were several, you know, for each, like the 9 a.m. slot. Yeah, there were the keynote in the morning. The 9 a.m. slot, you had five or six sessions you could choose from. You know, then lunch, then an afternoon session, then another afternoon session. And then they were all, you know, the trouble for me was trying to pin down which ones I wanted to go to. There were probably about five or six sessions I really wanted to attend that Saturday, and I could only do three.
Yeah, that's what always seems an issue to me when I'm even just sitting at home doing it virtually. It's like, which ones do I want to drop in and out of?
Right, right.
I think the one I actually attended the whole time was one that Devin was in on special ed and the gap between special ed and general ed students. And I found it to be one of those things that's quite interesting because you got a lot of the time was spent rather than what the facilitator had prepared in her PowerPoint was spent discussing does the exact gap exist and what makes it exist and how can we bring it together. And I always find that interesting. Attending virtually was different this year than it has been in the past because they used, I can't even remember what they were doing Illuminate sessions as opposed to doing it over Ustream like they did last year. Mm-hmm. And it made it more difficult to interact because the chat room wasn't active. More people were using Twitter instead. So it was a little harder to participate virtually than it has been in the past. But it was still worthwhile. I mean, I like attending virtually because I don't have to leave home, but also because I can get a whole variety of different sessions. And it's real easy to drop in and out if I get one that doesn't quite meet what I thought it was going to be about. And I love the conversations and hearing the panels, even if I'm sitting here in Michigan and it's going on in Pennsylvania. It's one of those things. Now, I understand from what I've figured out is that the students from the Science Leadership Academy participate in the conference. What's their roles while you were there? What did you see them doing?
Pretty much a little bit of everything. There were students kind of acting as tour guides. There were students acting as tech support. You know, a lot of the students were, in the sessions that I was in anyway, were operating the video cameras and setting up the Illuminate rooms and being, you know, they had like little, I guess, walkie-talkies or cell phones, and they were being called to different areas to help with, you know, put out fires as they came up. I know that some, I'm not sure if any SLA students were involved. I believe they were, but I didn't see any particularly. I believe they were also involved in actually facilitating some of the conversations. Devin, I don't know if you were in any of those.
No, I wasn't, but I know some one person, I don't remember who, brought his class with him from...
Christian,
that's right.
Christian
brought
Long,
his
yeah.
class with him, and they presented. Mm-hmm. And like Damien said, the SLA students were very much involved. In fact, the whole SLA community, parents, teachers, students, were running the whole show.
That's great. That's a... You know, so many times we go to these conferences, they're at big convention centers, and you don't get a real sense of the local people being directly involved. What sessions did you guys attend that, you know, you thought that you got a lot out of? What did you find some of the most interesting conversations?
Well, I think the one you mentioned of the one about the gap between general and special ed was interesting because it became, I thought, more about the gap between general ed teachers and special ed teachers more than the gaps between the achievement of the students. And I thought that was a lot of good conversation about our different perspectives on things. Another session I really liked was one that Sylvia Martinez ran on bringing play back into schools and into education. And that was great because she really facilitated having the new people, the first-timers, participate. I think there's a tendency for first-timers to hold back a bit. And Sylvia really gave us a chance to participate fully in the discussion.
Now, did she talk about that... Well, when she was dealing with play, was she talking about just recess time, or was she talking about more play in elementary classrooms, or
She was talking about play in all levels of education throughout the day. It wasn't play as you might think of it as little children do, but the sense that you have an opportunity to make mistakes, the chance to try things out, the chance to test yourself constantly and challenge yourself all the time in ways that schools don't allow now. It was called tinkering more than play. The word she used was tinkering, and tinkering used to be how we learned things. We would take something apart, try and put it back together, and she was advocating more tinkering at all levels of education.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, failure is with the emphasis on standardized testing, failure is not an option. I mean, for these kids. And how do you learn if you don't get something wrong the first time?
And especially in the timelines that these standardized tests create, you know, and that the districts create, you know, you don't have time to fail. Even if an individual teacher wants to encourage tinkering and failing and learning from failing, I know a lot of teachers feel they just don't have time to devote to that. And it is a lengthy process. You know, you try, you mess up, you make mistakes, you learn from your mistakes. It's lengthy. It doesn't necessarily happen according to your state's guidelines about when the test comes.
How true, how true. As we're gearing up now for a second week in March,
yep.
Michigan
March
Merit Exam Week. So,
HESPA's in New Jersey are the first week. We'll be ready for them.
No, we don't have tests till April and May. But the real problem that I see is these pacing calendars that you have to be at this, you know, point in the curriculum by this time. And if you're not, you know, there's hell to pay. Mm-hmm. This might work for teachers, but it certainly doesn't work for students, and certainly not for special ed students. The tinkering and failure requires time to do things over again and to try and get them right a second time, and that's what's missing.
Yeah, I see that. You know, I'm sure Damien did, especially when you're working with kids that have minimal writing skills and you're trying to bring them up. If they can't get back to the idea of revision and redoing, they're not going to produce quality work. And with the timelines, and I have this conversation with my colleagues all the time about, you know, they have drop dead, you know, due dates. It's not in. I can't grade it because I'm only going to grade this stack of papers at once. And maybe that kid actually needs to spend more time working and revising and working with the teacher to actually master whatever you wanted them to learn in that essay or express. And we don't have it. I mean, we've just got too much to cover. And that's hurting all the kids. I mean, good, bad, or indifferent. And I don't see how that's going to improve, you know, district test scores if you can't spend the time the kids need to master a concept. Damien, what session did you attend that you found particularly fascinating?
I found a couple of different. I went to go see Gary Steger speak first thing in the morning. I went to, and Gary, and I say this with all due respect and great love for what he does. He was extra cranky that morning, and I loved it. I really did because I read a lot of what he writes. I put a lot of his blog posts through my Google Reader shared items. He really was on in rare form that morning. There wasn't a lot of conversation happening. I wish there was a little more of that. It was primarily lecture from him. But I took voluminous notes during his session, and he just gave us a lot of food for thought, I think. A lot of things to think about in terms of the role of technology in education, and more importantly, just various aspects of education that he seems to think need rethinking. He did take some questions from the audience, which I thought were good questions. You know, we're talking about how to improve. You know, people ask, well, what are the roles of the universities and teacher training programs in improving education? And, you know, Gary talked a little bit to a kind of a catch-22 that he finds himself in, and that is, you know, you want your pre-service teachers to be innovative and radical and try these, you know, and be progressive, but he says we do that too much. You know, we tell them to be too radical or too progressive, they're not going to get jobs. He told us some stories about some of the districts he's worked with where they said, you know, you don't have I'm blanking on what the administrator said. Oh, the administrator knocked down one of his student teachers on an evaluation for being too idealistic. Which, yeah. and, you know, Gary says, well, gee, you know, you're 22, 23 years old. Maybe you should be a little idealistic, and maybe it would be great if you didn't go into the profession hating it. You know, think of what that would do for the students. And he just spoke a lot about the need for more collaboration, the need for constructive criticism, the need, you know, for us as teachers, I think, maybe to circle the wagons a little bit less. And I'm paraphrasing here, so don't, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But what I took from it was maybe circle the wagons a little bit less and be a little more introspective about how we can improve upon what we do. And I think Gary very much respects teachers. I think, as a, you know, obviously he's devoted his life to teaching and to education. But, you know, it was a little different than some of the other a lot of what else I read and hear around the around the blogs and such online. So I really enjoyed his session a lot.
Yeah, I always find Gary to be quite interesting and very willing to start a argument discussion going. I mean, sometimes I wonder how much of it's true and how much of it's tongue in cheek, but he's always willing to sort of push the envelope there.
And I think that's necessary. I've written a little bit about the echo chamber, and I'm not the only one. Other folks have too. And I think it's necessary a little bit just to kind of, you know, put a little pinprick in and kind of say, all right, you know, what we're doing is good, but let's maybe reevaluate, or let's maybe see what else is out there. You know, one thing I really have to thank him for is directing me towards a lot of, reading, you know, Ted Sizer, you know, more Dewey, stuff that I just wasn't exposed to in my undergrad teacher training program. And we're going back, you know, 10, 15 years now. I just didn't read any of that stuff. Some of it wasn't around. Some of it was, most of it was, but just wasn't brought to my attention. So I really have him to thank for bringing me back to the giants upon whose shoulders we stand in terms of ed philosophy.
Yeah, that's, I think back, you know, it's been, this is my 30th year in the classroom, and I think back to my education classes, and nobody had us back in the 70s, nobody really had us reading ed theorists. I mean, it was, hi, you're at a teacher college here, we're going to teach you things that you should be doing in class, you know, and statistics, and how you should fail so many kids because all your test results should hit the bell curve, and, that kind of stuff. And so that's one of the things I find real fascinating about just interacting with these people, either through EDUCON or online through Twitter, is that I'm getting a whole variety of different philosophies. I mean, that's how I met both of you, and I met Bert and Joe. And that's how I got into this, was making the contacts through Twitter and through Facebook and starting to listen and think. And it's really, I mean, it's really changed the way I teach and the way I look at it. Now, Devin, I sort of envy, you know, I sort of envy, and I sort of also am like, why would you go into education at 50? I mean,
I went into education at 50 because I dropped out of high school twice after having a magnificent time in middle school. And I always spent 30 years trying to figure out why one was so good and the other was so bad. And I still don't have a full answer, but I understand it a lot better now. I did not go to teacher training as an undergrad. My undergrad actually is in education history. So I did read Sizer and all those people as part of my undergrad training. And it really lit my fire to become a teacher much more than I had thought about I would do earlier.
And I can see, and that comes through in a lot, in almost everything you write and post and everything. That's one of the reasons I enjoy reading what you put out. It's interesting, especially since you and I are in the same generation here. So we know, mm-hmm. You know, we look at some of these younger folks, you know, Bert and Damien, and think, you guys, yeah, life has been going, we've been looking at, you know, look at it with a little longer lens. So it's sort of nice coming now with all this stuff being available, to be an older teacher, because aren't necessarily stuck in that old fogey category anymore. We have just as much access, if we seek it out, to these ideas that we never had before all this tech stuff came in there. I mean, I never would have been able to attend a national conference because the money's just not there in my district. But with EDUCON doing everything online, I can be there and I can interact with people actually in the sessions, which is what I find cool.
And that interaction element of EDUCON that we spoke to a little bit earlier is one of the things that I think, you know, not only differentiates it from the other conferences, but, you know, it was, again, another reason why I decided to go. I mean, it sounds shallow, and I wrote about this on my blog a little bit the night I got home. It sounds a little shallow to say, well, I went so I could meet, you know, folks face-to-face who I met on Twitter and Facebook and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, and that wasn't certainly the only reason I went. It was a contributing factor. It was to go and meet folks, you know, like Devin and Chris Lehman and, you know, Gary and, you know, John Becker and, you know, all these other folks, you know. But I think it speaks to the importance of relationships in this profession, not only relationships between professionals, relationships between teachers and other teachers, but relationships between teachers and students, that you have, you know, I wonder how much more can be accomplished when we have these positive relations. Teaching can be a very isolating profession, geographically, philosophically, ideologically. And I think that when you know that you're a member of a community, whether it's online or in person, or it starts online and it moves offline to in person, it like I said, EDUCON just really underscores the importance of these relationships. And I think about what would happen if all the folks who were at EDUCON, you know, got together and started their own school, or you know, some folks who are kind of geographically similar. Do they work in the same place? What could they do? What influence do they have? And again, you know, relationships are something that aren't really talked about too much in professional development training, but I think that it's, it's something the term PLN gets thrown around a lot in one of the, you know, Gary's one-liners. It sounds like a terrorist organization, the PLN. But
maybe we should be, you know.
Well, there you go. You know, I think it definitely speaks to the importance of not only ideas, but also I don't know a more eloquent way to say it other than relationships.
Well, yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, having Bert had a quote from Marzano from one of the conferences he attended. High schools especially are all independent contractors bound together by the same parking lot?
Yeah, that's a good quote.
I always think of that every time I get into a staff meeting and I look at people that I'm in the building with every day but I never see because we're not in the same part of the building. Mm-hmm. Except with those, you know, monthly required staff meetings. And that's, what can I learn from them if I had the opportunity to? And that's just not there. And so, I think in some ways professionally I'm closer to the people in my PLN than I am to some of the people I teach three or four doors from. Because during the day, I'm with the kids. I'm not out floating around talking to people and having some of these conversations that we probably should have.
That's certainly true for me. I think one of my big regrets in teaching in the city is that our contract has eliminated staff meetings. It's eliminated the times that teachers get to talk to each other. And I congratulate my principal for trying to build it into our schedule despite that. But I have way more interesting conversations on Twitter and at EDUCON than I ever have in my building. I'm fortunate that my school has broken into seven small learning communities, and the one that I'm in is a mixture of older people, older teachers, younger teachers who've been teaching a while, and brand new teachers. There are six of us, and we now have Nings, we now have a webpage, we now have a private Twitter network, we have all kinds of things that most of the school doesn't have. And it's been fun trying to introduce these things and see people pick up on them and run with them.
Did either of you get a chance to tour the Science Leadership Academy on Friday or?
Yeah, I did. It's an amazing place. I would love to teach there, and I'd actually much rather be a student there. It is a place that revolves around student learning. It's all it's about, and giving students the chance to take control of their learning. The science classes, of course, are tremendous, but I was very impressed by the history classes and English class, where it was pretty much all student run, and the school trusts its students and work, teaches them how to take charge of what they do. And it was just so much fun to just sit in and watch classes where the teacher played a secondary role.
Could you talk a little bit more about that? That sounds interesting. Is it project-based learning, or is it...
It's all project-based learning. Even in the English class, there was they were discussing a novel. And it's funny, I don't even know what novel it was, but the discussion was so engaging. The students were acting out scenes from the novel that they had rewritten, and they were presenting in little skits their rewriting of this novel and the different emphasis they all gave to different parts of this one scene. And it was just one group after another group after another group, and after between each group, the students would have a discussion about what they'd just seen, and the teacher was not part of it. It was just all student-run. In the science classes, the teacher was facilitating as the students looked for different kinds of bacterium in whatever sample they were using, and the students were charting it and doing things about it, wikis about it. And again, the teacher was just there to basically ask a question to set everybody off and running. It's all project-based, and it's all, totally dependent on trusting the student to do what the student needs to do to learn.
Did you find out how students got into the Science Leadership Academy? Did they apply, or did they draw from neighborhood, or what?
It's an application process. The school draws from all over Philadelphia. It's an application process. The students, as in middle school, fill out an application. They the applications get reviewed, and then Chris Lehman, the principal, interviews every student individually. And Chris makes the final decision in consultation with his staff. The students who are there definitely want to be there. They're excited about being there. They're excited about doing the work. They're excited about how they're being taught and how they're learning. And the place just hums with excitement.
Cool. Yeah, it always sounds like a fascinating place to be. I would just hope that once Chris moves on to somewhere else, that they can maintain that vision with the school.
There seems to be a very unified sense of purpose among the staff. They all use the same language talking about what they do and the principles of the school. They're all very much tied into one vision. And I think any new principal who might come in would have to fit him or herself to that vision.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. I think that Chris has done an outstanding job of surrounding himself with extremely competent staff and like-minded staff with a vision for the school. And I think that should he ever decide to move on, because of the groundwork he's laid, as Devin said, the existing principal would probably have to fit to that framework. But again, one thing that impressed me was walking. I didn't take a formal tour. I wasn't there long enough, but I did kind of walk around in between sessions and just kind of sightsee on my own. And in all the classrooms and throughout the halls, I kept noticing the I forget what the exact title, but it was basically the pillars of the school's philosophy. And they were all based around, respect, respect for each other, respect for ourselves, respect for the learning process. And, there was no flowery language. There was no, three-page long diatribe about what our school means or our mission statement or whatever. It was like four or five bullet-pointed items. And I think they're everywhere. The kids see them. The staff sees them. And that underscores, I think, again, the necessity of trust and good interpersonal relationships, because the parents, the students, the staff, the administration, everyone I saw there just seemed like part of a family. I hate to roll out the cliche, but that's really what it seemed like to me.
And that's the sense I got also. Everybody, parents were deeply involved in what happens at the school and in running EDUCON. Students certainly are deeply involved. And the conversations between students and teachers were so both friendly and respectful, that it was really inspiring.
I get a sense that everyone there, the teachers and the staff, the teachers and the students are all kind of colleagues in education. It's not, there's a less of a, I mean, certainly there's a hierarchy, you know, you have the teachers and the students, the administration, but I get the sense that, you know, and this goes back to something as simple as Chris allowing the kids to come sit on the couch in his office, you know, and just kind of talk with him. My principals throughout my schooling never had couches in their office. We were allowed to sit on and talk with. If you were in the principal's office, there was a reason, you know.
Yeah.
Actually not a good one. But I just get the sense that they're all kind of, you know, there's a sense of we're all in this together at science leadership in the best possible way.
Yeah, I agree.
Devin, I had a quick follow-up question, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the new village schools in New York. I read a book by Tony Wagner, Making the Grade, that talked a lot about Central Park East High School.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that? Or?
Yes, I am, actually.
I guess the reason I'm bringing up the question is, you know, you've talked a little bit about the vision of SLA and how that would continue. You feel even if Chris were out of leadership. But Tony Wagner made a big deal about Central Park East in his book, and I'm kind of doing I did a follow-up on it, and it seems like the school has not continued, the way it had originally set out.
No, it kind of got beaten into the ground. Central Park East High School was, again, a school created for a purpose, which was to change the way high schools operated in New York City, to provide an alternative way of doing things, and it worked for a number of years, and then the founders moved on to other things, and it lost direction. I think that was partially because the staff wasn't as stable as it's been in SLA. You need people to really buy in, and I don't think that Central Park East had the full buy-in that SLA does.
Okay, that makes sense.
Plus, SLA was created by the district to solve a problem. So it was created, the district understands what SLA is doing because that's what they wanted them to do. Central Park East was a force in opposition to the district in New York City. So it had a whole different genesis.
Okay. Well, I'm curious. You mentioned the stable staff of SLA. I was fortunate enough to see Chris speak a year or so ago. And one of the things that really blew my mind was the dedication of the teaching staff. I mean, he talked about the fact that they will teach until 6 o'clock at night and then hop on iChat in case the students have any follow-up questions. And I was worried about burnout or you know, teacher turnover after a couple of years of doing that. Did they talk at all about that?
No. I'm sure Chris is aware of the possibility of that happening, but that hasn't come up yet because the school has been growing by a grade each year, and this is, I believe, the first year that they're actually a full next year will be the first year that they're a full four-year school. Right now, the oldest kids they have, I believe, are juniors. So the burnout factor hasn't really come up yet. But again, I think that if an individual teacher does burn out and move on, there's enough of a core competency and enough of a core belief in the system that any new teacher would also have to fit into that set of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I would think the hiring to replace staff would be very crucial in keeping some of that going.
And I would think the staff would be involved in it.
I would hope they would be.
I believe they are. You know, I hear Chris and Diana Laufenberg and Zach Chase and the others on Twitter talking about, you know, it's interview weekend at SLA, or, you know, I think they're all, and I believe students sit on the interviews too. I could be wrong, but I seem to remember hearing that somewhere. So again, you know, it's kind of that whole family united purpose thing where everyone's a stakeholder and not just paying lip service to the idea of the term stakeholder. Everyone really does get a kind of a peek into the process.
Is there anything from EduCon that you are implementing with either your students or your colleagues? I mean, what sort of discussions has it spawned?
In my case, it's spawned a lot of interesting discussions in my academy as I present different ideas. This idea of tinkering has really caught on in my academy. We're trying to figure out how to work it into the way we teach. We've done some of it in producing a magazine for our academy that we sell to the school, and it's pretty much all student run. And so they tinker with it, and they tinker with the layouts and the cameras and the writing, all of that. That's work, but that's only been 25 of our 120 students. So we're still trying to work on that, but I think tinkering is the idea that's going to catch on in my group.
I think, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not a classroom teacher. I don't have I'm not really in a position to implement this stuff with working directly with students as I used to. But I've continued to basically evangelize to any of my colleagues who listen to me, and I'm sure some of them are getting sick of me at this point. But I've offered to help them set up projects. If folks want to try a wiki for the first time, if folks are interested in learning more about podcasting, I tell folks, yeah, just come to my office. We'll talk about it. I've taught every month we have a half day. It's kids have a half day, and teachers spend the afternoon in little professional development. Courses or what have you, and every so often the teachers are called. Some teachers are called upon to volunteer to teach a course. So I've done that. I taught a two-hour course on podcasting, a two-hour course on wikis throughout the course of the year. So I think that in some cases, and this was true of not only the school district where I'm currently working, but my previous one as well, there was a nice little model of teachers teaching teachers, which isn't exactly the same as Devin's little personal communities, but. We had rather than bringing in folks from the outside to tell us how we should be doing things, we drew upon kind of the homegrown talent to say, I've tried this. Here's what worked about it. Here's what was not so great about it. Here, if you're interested, here's how you can learn from my experiences. And I think that's been fairly well received by a lot of folks.
The two of you see any major themes at EDUCON moving forward?
I think there were a variety of themes that I saw. One was reinforcing notions of being student-centered. There was a lot of talk about creating caring classrooms, about changing the learning experience for students. So a lot of it was that. A lot of it was just this sense of networking, that we don't have to do this alone. It was one of the big purposes and themes of EDUCON. I was just looking back over the schedule. It's funny because I know I attended sessions and conversations, but it was hard for me to pick out specifically which ones I did because they were all so involved in discussions that happened during and after the sessions. And even if you weren't in one, you had the advantage of hearing about it and learning about it and feeling as if you had been. I think that's one of the big themes, is this exchange of ideas, this exchange of methods and techniques and ways of doing things.
Yeah, just to piggyback on that, I'll say openness seemed to be a theme that emerged to me, in terms of... There's not necessarily like an English, like traditionally we have English class, math class, and everything is kind of compartmentalized and set off to itself. From the experience I had at EDUCON, I got the sense that there's a lot more bleed over, a lot of overlapping. And I think that's good. I think that like Devin said, you've got the conversations that kind of bled over from the actual sessions themselves. Learning doesn't take place only between 8. I don't learn English from 8 to 8:45, and then I stop learning about English. Then I only learn math from 8:50 to 9:30 or whatever it is. I think the openness of the layout of the school, too, big wide hallways, nice open cafeteria, the physical layout reflects kind of that philosophical approach to just – this is a space of learning. These are not little classrooms of learning. The whole place is learning, and learning takes place while you're eating. Learning takes place while you're relaxing. Learning takes place while you're in class, while you're out of class. And that's something that I really took away from my experience there.
So, Damien, you mentioned earlier that you had a couple of tools that you really like to use.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought I'd mention Evernote. It's a fantastic program. It's one of these, web applications. It's free. You know, you can get a basic service for free, and you can pay to upgrade. It's one of the very few free services that I actually pay a yearly fee to use, because I found it so indispensable to my job. It's basically an electronic notebook. There's a desktop client you can have on your computer. It syncs to the it syncs securely to servers on the web, so you can also access it from via a web page. I can access it on my Android mobile phone. There's an iPhone app for it, of course, as there is for everything these days. And it's basically become a very useful organizational tool for me in my job as a psychologist. When I first opened up an Evernote account I was teaching, I didn't find much use for it in the way I had structured my organization then. But when I moved and I'm keeping, you know, case notes on meetings I'm having with students or with teachers, I'm needing to keep PDFs and reports and audio, you know, digital audio recordings archived somewhere easy for me to get to, Evernote stores it all, and stores. I think you can add 40 megabytes worth of information a month, worth of data a month for free. If you pay $40 a year, you get 500 meg. I'm very type A with how I organize my notebooks, but you could really use it as a brain dump and just make it entirely searchable. It scans PDFs, it scans pictures. If you take a picture of a whiteboard of notes, the optical character recognition software is excellent. You could basically everything electronic you need to save, you could dump into Evernote and just make it searchable, and it would all be in one location. It's kind of like an iTunes for my notes and for my articles I need for work, and also articles I like to share. You can create shared notebooks that, if you have a group of people who are all working on something, you can almost like a wiki. You can have that element of it. And you can also have a notebook that creates like an RSS feed that people can subscribe to. And I certainly took advantage of that. I have one folder in my Evernote account that I call Articles of Interest. And I use those for any kind of PDF article I come across that I find interesting on educational technology or educational reform or assistive tech or UDL or anything related to my job. I dump in there. And folks can subscribe to that. They can either go to a web page and access it, or they can subscribe, and these articles will show up in their RSS reader. So this has kind of like become my Google Reader shared items feed for actual PDF articles. And I'm a big fan. I've been using it for a little over a year now, and I would have a very difficult time keeping organized in my job without it.
Yeah, I've tried Evernote, and you're right. As a classroom teacher, I don't have a big use for it at this point, but I can see, knowing what you guys do with you psychologists have to do, it would be an amazing organizational resource.
Well, I'm wondering, taking a look at it, I didn't realize they had added the ability to include audio clips. This would be a phenomenal organizational tool for students to use.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's you know, it's something that I kind of wish I had when I was in grad school. You know, for my keeping, you know, notes, I have, you know, certainly handwritten notebooks full of information that I will probably never look through again. But if I could keep it all archived in a digital format, I could certainly go back. It would take 2 seconds to search for something, you know, that I needed from my any of my grad classes. I think the same would hold true of a kid in high school, middle school. You know, spend a little time teaching them the tool, as long as they had access to a computer with internet access, which I know isn't the case for every student. But as it's becoming more ubiquitous, I think this could be a potentially a very good organizational tool for kids.
Yeah,
I could too. Now just write into an IEP somewhere.
Yeah.
As an accommodation, and you've got it made. Do you have anything else for us, Damien?
I could go on all day about all the tech tools I love, but the one thing I will say, I've been using MediaWiki, which is the wiki software that Wikipedia is built on, and I have to say I was very intimidated by it at first, and I don't know if it would necessarily be good for using with students, although I know that, and if you give me a second, I can call up my Twitter account. Someone on Twitter said they have used MediaWiki with students to create wikis, and they loved it. Elizabeth Helfant in St. Louis, Missouri. Her Twitter name is E. Helfant. she has said that she's used media wikis with her students to create what she calls wiki books, and she sent me some links to what she did. I'm actually planning on starting a doctoral program within the next year and a half or so, and I have decided that I'm going to keep all my notes and read dissertation information and everything on this wiki and release it under a Creative Commons license. So kind of the first step toward that, you know, it was actually setting the wiki up and getting familiar with how to use it. And again, it was a little intimidating at first, but once I got into it and, you know, rolled my sleeves up and started playing with it, again, this is going to be something that's going to be publicly available, searchable. You know, all my notes will be readily available in a way that my stuff on my spiral bound notebooks are not. And I'm excited about incorporating this into my study.
Yeah, I still have milk crates filled with things I might have used from graduate and undergrad days, and I've
right.
never looked at them.
Yep. Just,
yeah, having them searchable, I think, makes a big difference.
Yes.
Now, Damian, MediaWiki, are you talking about setting up a wiki using the engine so that people will be able to assist you in your doctoral studies by editing your notes or collaborating with you?
No, it is set up on a private domain, but my goal is not really to have other folks help me with it. It's more to just as a basically an online notebook for myself. And if folks, you know, write my plan right now is to just keep it to only allowing myself to edit it. Once my studies are done, though, I'd have to reevaluate at that time. I wouldn't be averse to the idea of opening it up and allowing other folks to play.
Yeah, that would be fun. No, I noticed yesterday there was a conversation going on with Linda Clinton. Had a question for her working on her doctorate, and she sent something out there, and she heard from Carosa or Shoresky, one of the two of them, and referred her to someplace else, and they were discussing the fact that they needed to set up a wiki or a community somewhere for doctoral candidates so they could work with each other to help share questions, especially as you're analyzing study groups and statistics and what makes...
A few of us had talked about that a couple weeks ago. Jen Ansbach and Mike Ritzius and I are all kind of kicking the idea of the doctoral program around we had talked, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek about setting up a wiki for information like, where to go for, you know, how are we going to pay for this, you know, resources, things along those lines. But, you know, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if one exists already. I haven't searched for one. But if one doesn't, it would be very easy to set up. And just to go back to the other question about, you know, why, I guess, a wiki. I've been critical in the past of folks who said, well, we had to set up a wiki when a regular website would suffice, you know. And I know the primary purpose of wikis is for collaboration. But for me, as far as what I liked about using this particular medium for a notebook instead of a traditional, like setting up a WordPress website, is I think the wiki text language is very easy. I can create pages and notebooks with a couple of I can create links to pages and create these pages in a couple of keystrokes. So if I need to, and I can also link to outside resources that you maybe could do with a WordPress blog or with a standard HTML web page, but it just, to me anyway, seems a lot more convenient to do within the wiki text markup language.
Yeah, I could see that. Working on a traditional web page is, in some ways, it's more limiting because it's much harder to edit on a regular basis. I mean, I tend to use the wikis that I do tend to frequently end up being my web page.
Right. And that's a valid use of a wiki. I've done it myself, but you know, to me, that the true benefit of a wiki comes when there's collaboration. You know, and that's something that doesn't always take place. You know, and that's true of wikis I've been involved in and have set up. You know, so I don't want to point fingers, but I think that, you know, having a wiki as a web page is okay. But the better, I think, use of a wiki is when it's collaborative and when it's drawing upon the knowledge of many people in your crowd.
Yeah, I think, I agree. I think one of the things that holds people back when they're doing that collaboration on the wiki is the sense of, well, this isn't really mine, so I don't know how much to add. I mean, if it's an open
wiki. Right.
But if you're working with a group of people and everybody understands the same intent, it's probably easier. It's great having you guys. I'm sure I'll be talking to you, both of you, later.
Absolutely. Sure. Thank you very much for having us.
I enjoyed getting the view into EDUCON. That's I appreciate you two taking the time to do that. That's been eye-opening for me.
It's been a pleasure for me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. We look forward to getting together with you in a few weeks as Joe and I get back from various conferences out west. I will be attending the Q conference, and Joe will be attending the Q conference and the ASCD conference in San Antonio. So hopefully we'll have lots of conference goodies to share with you. And Karen will be preparing to present at her own conference. So come back soon, and we look forward to chatting with you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the California Technology Assistance Project, Region 6. You can find handy links from the show, and we always welcome your feedback or questions at our website, edtechclassroom.com. That's edtechclassroom.com. Thanks for listening.